Chapter 16. Unless it be a delusion born of my giddy flight, the grown-up people and the children seem to change places in France. In general, the boys and girls are little old men and women, and the men and women lively boys and girls. Bugle, shriek, flight resumed. Money interest has come into my carriage. Says the manner of refreshing is not bad, apostrophe but considers it French. Admits great dexterity and politeness in the attendance. Thinks a decimal currency may have something to do with their dispatch in settling accounts, and don't know, but what it's sensible and convenient. Adds, however, as a general protest, that they're a revolutionary people and always at it. Ramparts, canals, cathedral, river, soldiering, and drumming, open country, river, earthenware manufactures, crail. Again 10 minutes. Not even demented in a hurry. Station, a drawing room with a veranda. Like a planter's house. Moneyed interest considers it a bandbox, and not made to last. Little round tables in it, at one of which the sister artists and attendant mysteries are established with wasp and zamiel, as if they were going to stay a week. Anon, with no more trouble than before, I am flying again, and lazily wondering as I fly. What has the southeastern done with all the horrible little villages we used to pass through, in the diligence? What have they done with all the summer dust, with all the winter mud, with all the dreary avenues of little trees, with all the ramshackle post yards, with all the beggars who used to turn out at night with bits of lighted candle, to look in at the coach windows, with all the long-tailed horses who were always biting one another, with all the big postilions in jackboots, with all the moldy cafes that we used to stop at, where a long mildewed tablecloth, set forth with jovial bottles of vinegar and oil, and with a Siamese arrangement of pepper and salt, was never wanting. Where are the grass-grown little towns, the wonderful little marketplaces all unconscious of markets, the shops that nobody kept, the streets that nobody trod, the churches that nobody went to, the bells that nobody rang, the tumble-down old buildings plastered with many-colored bills that nobody read? Where are the 22 weary hours of long, long day and night journey, sure to be either insupportably hot or insupportably cold? Where are the pains in my bones? Where are the fidgets in my legs? Where is the Frenchman with the nightcap who never would have the little coupe window down, and who always fell upon me when he went to sleep, and always slept all night snoring onions? A voice breaks in with Paris. Here we are. Apostrophe, I have overflown myself, perhaps, but I can't believe it. I feel as if I were enchanted or bewitched. It is barely 8 o'clock, yet it is nothing like half past, when I have had my luggage examined at that briskest of custom houses attached to the station, and am rattling over the pavement in a hackney cabriolet. Surely, not the pavement of Paris? Yes, I think it is too. I don't know any other place, where there are all these high houses, all these haggard-looking wine shops, all these billiard tables, all these stocking makers with flat red or yellow legs of wood for signboard, all these fuel shops with stacks of billets painted outside, and real billets sawing in the gutter, all these dirty corners of streets, all these cabinet pictures over dark doorways representing discreet matrons nursing babies. And yet this morning I'll think of it in a warm bath. Very like a small room that I remember in the Chinese baths upon the boulevard, certainly. And, though I see it through the steam, I think that I might swear to that peculiar hot linen basket, like a large wicker hourglass. When can it have been that I left home? When was it that I paid through to Paris's at London Bridge, and discharged myself of all responsibility, except the preservation of a voucher ruled in 2-3 divisions, of which the first was snipped off at Folkestone, the second aboard the boat, and the third taken at my journey's end? It seems to have been ages ago. Calculation is useless. I will go out for a walk. the crowds in the streets, the lights in the shops and balconies, the elegance, variety, and beauty of their decorations, the number of the theaters, the brilliant cafes with their windows thrown up high, and their vivacious groups at little tables on the pavement, the light and glitter of the houses turned as it were inside out, soon convince me that it is no dream, that I am in Paris, howsoever I got there. I stroll down to the sparkling Palace Royal, up the Rue de Rivoli, to the Place Vendôme. As I glance into a print shop window, moneyed interest, my late traveling companion, comes upon me, laughing with the highest relish of disdain. Here's a people. Apostrophe, apostrophe, he says, pointing to Napoleon in the window and Napoleon on the column. Only one idea all over Paris. A monomania. Apostrophe, humph. I think I have seen Napoleon's match. There was a statue, when I came away, at Hyde Park Corner, and another in the city, and a print or two in the shops. I walk up to the Barrière de l'Étoile, sufficiently dazed by my flight, to have a pleasant doubt of the reality of everything about me, of the lively crowd, the overhanging trees, the performing dogs, the hobby horses, the beautiful perspectives of shining lamps, the 101 enclosures, where the singing is, in gleaming orchestras of azure and gold, and where a star-eyed houri comes round with a box for voluntary offerings. So, I pass to my hotel, enchanted. Sup, enchanted. Go to bed, enchanted. Pushing back this morning, if it really were this morning, into the remoteness of time, blessing the Southeastern Company for realizing the Arabian Nights in these prose days, murmuring, as I wing my idle flight into the land of dreams, no hurry, ladies and gentlemen, going to Paris in 11 hours. It is so well done, that there really is no hurry. Apostrophe, apostrophe, the detective police. We are not by any means devout believers in the old Bow Street police. To say the truth, we think there was a vast amount of humbug about those worthies. Apart from many of them being men of very indifferent character, and far too much in the habit of consorting with thieves and the like, they never lost a public occasion of jobbing and trading in mystery, and making the most of themselves. Continually puffed besides by incompetent magistrates anxious to conceal their own deficiencies, and hand in glove with the pennier liners of that time, they became a sort of superstition. Although as a preventive police they were utterly ineffective, and as a detective police were very loose and uncertain in their operations, they remain with some people a superstition to the present day. On the other hand, the detective force organized since the establishment of the existing police is so well chosen and trained, proceeds so systematically and quietly, does its business in such a workmanlike manner, and is always so calmly and steadily engaged in the service of the public, that the public really do not know enough of it to know a tithe of its usefulness. Impressed with this conviction, and interested in the men themselves, we represented to the authorities at Scotland Yard that we should be glad, if there were no official objection, to have some talk with the detectives. A most obliging and ready permission being given, a certain evening was appointed with a certain inspector for a social conference between ourselves and the detectives, at the Household Words office in Wellington Street, Strand, London. In consequence of which appointment the party came off, apostrophe which we are about to describe. And we beg to repeat that, avoiding such topics as it might for obvious reasons be injurious to the public, or disagreeable to respectable individuals, to touch upon in print, our description is as exact as we can make it. The reader will have the goodness to imagine the sanctum sanctorum of Household Words. Anything that best suits the reader's fancy will best represent that magnificent chamber. We merely stipulate for a round table in the middle, with some glasses and cigars arranged upon it, and the editorial sofa elegantly hemmed in between that stately piece of furniture and the wall. It is a sultry evening at dusk. The stones of Wellington Street are hot and gritty, and the waterman and hackney coachman at the theater opposite are much flushed and aggravated. Carriages are constantly setting down the people who have come to Fairyland, and there is a mighty shouting and bellowing every now and then, deafening us for the moment, through the open windows. Just at dusk, Inspectors Wield and Stalker are announced, but we do not undertake to warrant the orthography of any of the names here mentioned. Inspector Wield presents Inspector Stalker. Inspector Wield is a middle-aged man of a portly presence, with a large, moist, knowing eye, a husky voice, and a habit of emphasizing his conversation by the aid of a corpulent forefinger, which is constantly in juxtaposition with his eyes or nose. Inspector Stalker is a shrewd, hard-headed Scotchman in appearance, not at all unlike a very acute, thoroughly trained schoolmaster from the normal establishment at Glasgow. Inspector Wield one might have known, perhaps, for what he is Inspector Stalker, never. The ceremonies of reception over, Inspectors Wield and Stalker observe that they have brought some sergeants with them. The sergeants are presented five in number, Sergeant Thornton, Sergeant Wicham, Sergeant Myth, Sergeant Fendel, and Sergeant Straw. We have the whole detective force from Scotland Yard, with one exception. They sit down in a semicircle, the two inspectors at the two ends, at a little distance from the round table, facing the editorial sofa. Every man of them, in a glance, immediately takes an inventory of the furniture, and an accurate sketch of the editorial presence. The editor feels that any gentleman in company could take him up, if need should be, without the smallest hesitation, 20 years hence. The whole party are in plain clothes. Sergeant Thornton about 50 years of age, with a ruddy face and a high sunburnt forehead, has the air of one who has been a sergeant in the army. He might have sat to Wilkie for the soldier in the reading of the will. He is famous for steadily pursuing the inductive process, and, from small beginnings, working on from clue to clue until he backs his man. Sergeant Wicham, shorter and thicker set, and marked with the smallpox, has something of a reserved and thoughtful air, as if he were engaged in deep arithmetical calculations. He is renowned for his acquaintance with the swell mob. Sergeant Myth, a smooth-faced man with a fresh bright complexion, and a strange air of simplicity, is a dab at housebreakers. Sergeant Fendel, a light-haired, well-spoken, polite person, is a prodigious hand at pursuing private inquiries of a delicate nature. Straw, a little wiry sergeant of meek demeanor and strong sense, would knock at a door and ask a series of questions in any mild character you choose to prescribe to him, from a charity boy upwards, and seem as innocent as an infant. They are, one and all, respectable-looking men, of perfectly good deportment and unusual intelligence, with nothing lounging or slinking in their manners, with an air of keen observation and quick perception when addressed, and generally presenting in their faces traces more or less marked of habitually leading lives of strong mental excitement. They have all good eyes, and they all can, and they all do, look full at whomsoever they speak to. We light the cigars, and hand round the glasses, which are very temperately used indeed, and the conversation begins by a modest amateur reference on the editorial part to the swell mob. Inspector Wield immediately removes his cigar from his lips, waves his right hand, and says, regarding the swell mob, sir, I can't do better than call upon Sergeant Wicham. Because the reason why? I'll tell you. Sergeant Wicham is better acquainted with the swell mob than any officer in London. Apostrophe, our heart leaping up when we beheld this rainbow in the sky, we turned to Sergeant Wicham, who very concisely, and in well-chosen language, goes into the subject forthwith. Meantime, the whole of his brother officers are closely interested in attending to what he says, and observing its effect. Presently they begin to strike in, one or two together, when an opportunity offers, and the conversation becomes general. but these brother officers only come in to the assistance of each other, not to the contradiction and a more amicable brotherhood there could not be. From the swell mob, we diverge to the kindred topics of cracksmen, fences, public house dancers, area sneaks, designing young people who go out gunnifing, apostrophe and other schools. Apostrophe, it is observable throughout these revelations, that Inspector Stalker, the Scotchman, is always exact and statistical, and that when any question of figures arises, everybody as by one consent pauses, and looks to him. When we have exhausted the various schools of art during which discussion the whole body have remained profoundly attentive, except when some unusual noise at the theater over the way has induced some gentleman to glance inquiringly towards the window in that direction, behind his next neighbor's back we burrow for information on such points as the following. Whether there really are any highway robberies in London, or whether some circumstance is not convenient to be mentioned by the aggrieved party, usually precede the robberies complained of, under that head, which quite change their character. Certainly the latter, almost always. Whether in the case of robberies in houses, where servants are necessarily exposed to doubt, innocence under suspicion ever becomes so like guilt in appearance, that a good officer need be cautious how he judges it? Undoubtedly. Nothing is so common or deceptive as such appearances at first. Whether in a place of public amusement, a thief knows an officer, and an officer knows a thief, supposing them, beforehand, strangers to each other, because each recognizes in the other, under all disguise, an inattention to what is going on, and a purpose, that is not the purpose of being entertained? Yes. That's the way exactly. Whether it is reasonable, or ridiculous to trust to the alleged experiences of thieves as narrated by themselves, in prisons, or penitentiaries, or anywhere. In general, nothing more absurd. Lying is their habit and their trade, and they would rather lie, even if they hadn't an interest in it, and didn't want to make themselves agreeable than tell the truth. From these topics, we glide into a review of the most celebrated and horrible of the great crimes that have been committed within the last 15 or 20 years. The men engaged in the discovery of almost all of them, and in the pursuit or apprehension of the murderers, are here, down to the very last instance. One of our guests gave chase to, and boarded the emigrant ship, in which the murderess last hanged in London was supposed to have embarked. We learn from him that his errand was not announced to the passengers, who may have no idea of it to this hour. That he went below, with the captain, lamp in hand it being dark, and the whole steerage abed and seasick, and engaged the Mrs. Manning who was on board, in a conversation about her luggage, until she was, with no small pains, induced to raise her head, and turn her face towards the light. Satisfied that she was not the object of his search, he quietly re-embarked in the government steamer alongside, and steamed home again with the intelligence. When we have exhausted these subjects too, which occupy a considerable time in the discussion, two or three leave their chairs, whisper Sergeant Wycham, and resume their seat. Sergeant Wycham, leaning forward a little, and placing a hand on each of his legs, then modestly speaks as follows. My brother officers wish me to relate a little account of my taking Tally-ho Thompson. A man oughtn't to tell what he has done himself. But still, as nobody was with me, and, consequently, as nobody but myself can tell it, I'll do it in the best way I can, if it should meet your approval. Apostrophe, we assure Sergeant Wycham that he will oblige us very much, and we all compose ourselves to listen with great interest and attention. Tally-ho Thompson, apostrophe, says Sergeant Wycham, after merely wetting his lips with his brandy and water, Tally-ho Thompson was a famous horse stealer, coureur, and magsman. Thompson, in conjunction with a pal that occasionally worked with him, gammoned a countryman out of a good round sum of money, under pretense of getting him a situation the regular old dodge, and was afterwards in the hue and cry for a horse that he stole down in Hertfordshire. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.